listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2021, January 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which features Jennifer Lawrence on the cover. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the editor's letter from Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief. My high school American history teacher had two turns of phrase that have stuck with me for 30 years. First, she consistently referred to our textbook by its author's last name, Garrity. Though we never talked about John Garrity, who I later learned was born in Brooklyn and served in World War II, and who, in addition to his tenured faculty position at Columbia, also acted as a consultant on Schoolhouse Rock, Mrs. Dixon made her point. Textbooks are written by people. History is written by people, and its writers change over time. The other phrase of Mrs. Dixon's that lodged in my brain is, "Your point is well taken," which she would trot out frequently in the midst of a class debate. It was aggravating to hear. All I wanted to know was whether my point was correct. But she was after something deeper, modeling an absorption of competing ideas, allowing for contradiction and a nuance. Suggesting, perhaps, that when it comes to American history, none of us is likely to be absolutely right or wrong, but that there is value in acknowledging people's good faith arguments. I've been reading The 1619 Project, a new origin story created by Nicole Hannah-Jones, whom we profile in this issue, and thinking about how history happens. Not how the events themselves happen, but how the chronicling of them takes root in the culture, how those events are processed and taught and memorialized. It has been remarkable to watch Hannah-Jones' work travel over the past 2 years. From the New York Times Magazine issue, where she published her essay arguing for 1619 as a foundational date, the year, she writes in the new preface, white Virginians first purchased enslaved Africans, into presidential debates and high school classrooms and the chyrons under apoplectic pundits. The breadth of her project's dissemination and its ability to spark debate speaks to the power and clarity of her proposition, even though it has also left her, as Alexis Okeowo writes, exhausted by disingenuous attacks. The way the 1619 Project has reoriented our national conversation about race and history put me in mind of another formative textbook, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn, who popularized the notion of the paradigm shift as a way to understand transformational advances in science. He explains it this way: the everyday work of science, experimentation and discovery, is conducted within a shared understanding of the universe and its governing rules. When that shared understanding, or paradigm, changes, it brings about new rules and an entirely new set of puzzles that scientists must solve. From the Ptolemaic worldview to the Copernican to the Galilean to the Newtonian to the Einsteinian, the physical world doesn't change, but our perception and comprehension of it does. That means that scientific progress is not necessarily cumulative or linear. It can involve re-examining past truths under changed circumstances. During revolutions, Kuhn writes, scientists see new and different things when looking with familiar instruments in places they have looked before. Paradigm shifts come about when the presiding worldview becomes insufficient to explain the phenomena that arise in scientific exploration. Ptolemy's theory of the universe accounted for a lot, but but it couldn't account for certain complexities that Copernicus did, and so on. The work of science within a paradigm is painstaking, incremental, and often slow. The paradigm shift itself represents a leap. But the point of a new paradigm is not that it answers every unsolved riddle of the previous one. On the contrary, the mark of its success is that it advances enough to provide a forum for a whole new chapter of inquiry. It enables scientists to ask questions about, say, the position of Earth, the nature and speed of light, the size of the universe that they didn't even know to ask before. I read The Structure of Scientific Revolutions in graduate school in the humanities, the idea being that the paradigm shift as a concept could apply not just to the hard sciences, but to literature and literary study, to linguistics, to history. And it has felt to me, watching those four digits, 1619, spread through our national discourse, that we are witnessing one now. If that makes some people uncomfortable, well, revolutions tend to do that. This shift has been decades in the making. Hannah Jones writes in her preface to the book about her own eureka moment, when as a teenager she discovered the story of 1619, and she also cites the historians whose scholarship has, as she puts it, redefined the field of American history since at least the 1960s. Benjamin Quarles, Eric Foner, Annette Gordon Reed, and others. Her framing of the project, combined with its journalistic outlet, helped take that redefinition mainstream. The point of the 1619 Project is not that it provides all the answers or is immune to criticism or nuance. The point is that Hannah Jones and her fellow contributors, professors, playwrights, poets, are asking innovative and valuable questions about our past that also illuminate our present. Questions about the roots of American democracy and wealth and opportunity. Their familiar instruments are words, and they are seeing, to quote Kuhn, new and different things in places where we've looked before.
Thank you.
Here are some of the contributors to the issue. Lisa Robinson, Pair of Aces. Interviewing Alison Krauss and Robert Plant was a full circle moment for me, says Vanity Fair contributing editor Lisa Robinson, who traveled with Plant on 5 Led Zeppelin tours. Robinson has interviewed hundreds of musicians. Her book, Nobody Ever Asked Me About the Girls, published in 2020, is out in paperback this month. Sebastian Younger, The End of Forever. Younger, a best-selling author and co-director, with his late friend Tim Hetherington of the acclaimed war documentary Restrepo, wrote about the U.S.'s calamitous exit from Afghanistan, a country he reported in and on throughout the course of its last 20 years of conflict. Alexis Okeowo, Eyes on the Prize. Okeowo, who profiled New York Times writer Nicole Hannah-Jones, is a veteran journalist and author. They have long shared professional circles with Hannah-Jones, creator of the Lightning Rod 1619 Project, and found their conversation yielded new perspective. Nicole was refreshingly open, funny, and as honest as ever, Okeowo says. Lachlan Bailey, A Happy New Year. It is somewhat intimidating to work with an actress of her caliber, but her laid-back energy in front of the camera made it easy, says photographer Bailey of this month's cover story, Jennifer Lawrence. A Los Angeles house, once owned by Frank Sinatra, helped capture the sensuality and the sunshine he hoped to evoke, drawing inspiration from classic French cinema. Sebastian Kim, Down to Earth and Rock Star. Kim, who photographed both Amazon CEO Andy Jassy and Louis Vuitton's Francesca Amfitheroff, learned the significance of connecting with a subject to tell their unique story early in his career. The photographer's work, he says, is influenced by his experiences apprenticing for Richard Avedon. Melissa Jeltson, She Was Walking Home. Sarah's death tapped into a larger debate about how best to protect women from male violence, says Jeltson of the death of Sarah Everard, the 33-year-old British woman murdered by a police officer in 2020. As a reporter, Jeltson has long been fascinated by feminism's relationship to criminal justice, particularly which women the system prioritizes. Now for the Vanity Fair agenda, promotions, events. Visit. Go back to the movies at the Academy Museum. The new Academy Museum of Motion Pictures, located in the heart of Los Angeles, is a museum in the United States solely devoted to the art, science, and technology of movie making. In addition to 6 floors of spectacular cinematic exhibitions, the Academy Museum features the most spectacular new state-of-the-art movie theaters in Los Angeles. Join us for daily screenings, panel discussions, retrospectives, weekly family matinees, Oscar-winning films, and more. Reconnect with cinema classics and discover new favorites at the Academy Museum. In the photos, David Geffen Theater, the 1,000-seat David Geffen Theater, situated inside the Sphere building of the Academy Museum, hosts screenings, performances, conversations, and other special events. Equipped to present film in formats including nitrate, 35mm, 70mm, and laser projection. Laura Dern and Diane Ladd. The Academy Museum launched its Legacy Conversation series with Academy Award winner Laura Dern and her award-winning mother Diane Ladd in the museum's David Geffen Theater. Malcolm X. Academy Museum members enjoyed an exclusive screening of Spike Lee's Malcolm X. Featured guests included, pictured here, Ruth E. Carter, Denzel Washington, Robbie Reed, Angela Bassett, Ernest R. Dickerson, Spike Lee, and Wynne P. Thomas. Gold House. New Gold Order, from film to fashion to finance, Asian leaders and Gold House are reforging culture. With opening photo by Daniel Sung Lee. Pictured are Eileen Lee, Amrita Ahuja, Anish Shaganti, Bao Nguyen, Bing Chen, Daniel Day Kim, Destin Daniel Cretton, Eric Feng, Gina Rosero, James Rowe, Janet Yang, John M. Chu, Katrina Lake, Kev Nish, Lisa Ling, Michelle Lee, Nina Yang Bon Jovi, Philip Lim, and Praval Garung. Looking for a French connection? Try Emily in Paris star Lucas Bravo by Britt Hinemuth, with photographs by Nick Riley Bentham. Gen X had Carrie and Big. Gen Z has Emily and Gabriel. Just ask Lucas Bravo, an avowed Sex and the City fan, who also leads Emily in Paris as the titular American stray French love interest. Of course, it's more modern because it's 20 years later, the 33-year-old Nice native says of Emily, now in its second season, and which, like Sex and the City, was created by Darren Star. But it was a bit challenging because it could have been easy to be hated. Fans of the surprise Netflix hit certainly don't feel that way about Bravo, unless they've got something against bilingual chefs with perfect bone structure. Neither do the casting agents, scooping him up for a succession of projects that place the actor opposite everyone from Julia Roberts to Borat Oscar nominee Maria Bakalova. His father's professional soccer career frequently uprooted Bravo's family, moving them to a new town in the French Riviera or Italy every 2 years. Bravo, the emotional one of 4 siblings, saw acting class as the first time I felt comfortable. It was an emergency in the beginning, and then it grew into a passion. After a brief stint in law school, a chance visit to Los Angeles re-sparked his on-screen ambitions. Previous restaurant experience also helped him score the role of Gabriel, a talented chef. His culinary stunt double does a lot of waiting around, Bravo says. He likes to show off his own knife skills when he can. Speaking of Sex and the City, Bravo confesses he's a Samantha. I mean Kim Cattrall. You go to set, get naked, and make it funny. She went 200%. He understands Emily skeptics, particularly those who are actual Parisians. I think it's the charm of the French people. They're never happy about anything. But ultimately, he's empowered by people who tell him the show transported them to France, despite the pandemic. He promises season two is less about being a fish out of water and more escapist, with new locations and even bigger fashion moments from costume designers Patricia Field and Marilyn Fitoussi. They're icons. The big screen beckons, with Bravo featuring in a number of upcoming films. He plays opposite Roberts and George Clooney in Ticket to Paradise, Bakalova in The Honeymoon, and Isabelle Huppert in Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. Her sarcasm is next level, he says, of working with the French icon. You really need some self-confidence. Since skyrocketing to global fame, and after braving both the Cannes and Venice film festivals, there's no world in which I feel comfortable in front of a wall of flashes. Instead, Bravo is happiest hiking on his mother's home island, Corsica. You lie on the grass, the cows and wild horses, the lakes, where you can bathe naked, and the stars are. It's perfect to disconnect. No service. It's my spot. Rhyme and Reason. Inaugural youth poet laureate Amanda Gorman shares the cultural touchstones behind her upcoming collection, Call Us What We Carry, out from Viking Books. Pandemic 1918, Eyewitness Accounts from the Greatest Medical Holocaust in Modern History by Catherine Arnold, published by St. Martin's Press. While writing my collection, it was a book that provided me with vital insight into how people had historically dealt with a global health crisis. Dickinson on Apple TV Plus. I watched a lot of the Apple TV Plus series Dickinson. Emily Dickinson spent so much of her life writing poetry in isolation, and as a young poetess quarantining, I really connected with it. Time by Hans Zimmer. When I write, I listen to instrumentals or songs from movie scores that tell a story. I love to listen to composers who I feel are great storytellers, but they don't use words, so I try to fill in that rhetoric myself. Thank you. from the Vanity's My Stuff, NEDA Porter President Allison Lunis gives a primer in posh pleasures, and while her favorite things may dazzle with sapphires and sequins, her Manolos are made for walking. Style file, party shoe. I'm a firm believer in never wearing shoes you cannot walk in. Manolo and Gianvinito Rossi are my go-tos. Festive frock, a Gucci green sequin jacket. I don't wear a lot of embellishment, but this is an exception. On beauty, holiday glam. My holiday makeup does not really vary from my usual day-to-day products. I use Westman Atelier's highlighter and mascara, a Black NARS eyeliner pencil, Tom Ford gel liner, and a La Mer lip balm to complete the look. Skin Saver, Dr. Barbara Sturm Hyaluronic Acid. At home, recent edition, a photograph by Massimo Vitali that I have coveted for years. Reading, The Island of Missing Trees by Elif Shafak. The Art of Gifting, last minute, a low home scents candle. They are big, smell, and look great, and are something a bit different. For a romantic partner, breakfast in bed. For the person who has everything, an Alexandra Llewellyn backgammon set. Each is unique, beautifully handcrafted, and exquisite to look at, even when not in use. Stocking stuffer, Chloe's alphabet necklace, small enough to put in the stocking and thoughtful. Personal favorite, an Art Deco sapphire ring from the 1920s, gifted to me by my husband. The color reminds me of the Mediterranean Sea, and him, of course. For the fashion forward, Bottega Veneta's The Pouch in emerald green is a surefire winner. It's both festive and classic for any fashion lover's wardrobe, and can carry a huge amount, too. And this on beauty from Laura Regensdorf, with photograph by Adrienne Raquel. Melting point. So Jin Oh is an uncanny interpreter of extremities. For the Los Angeles-based nail artist, inspiration comes from bacteria strains, sea creatures, and Rene Redzepi's fungi haul. Lil Nas X recently glimmered in O's beaded chrome nails. Hunter Schafer wore a crystalline set to the Met Gala. The sublime beauty of the natural world influences me to be adventurous, says the scuba-certified Korean native. But there's a portentous undercurrent in these fire and ice nails, pictured here, shaded by the realities of living in a state routinely ablaze. O cites lava as a muse because it's seen as destructive and violent, but it is also creating and generating new life. Even as O dreams of designing nails for a sci-fi film someday, she hopes her work, embellished with water droplets or gecko spots, inspires solidarity with Mother Earth. Madison Reed gives us this on books through the lens. In her new book, Annie Leibovitz showcases 5 decades of singular fashion photography. Since becoming one of Vanity Fair's first contributors at its relaunch in 1983, Annie Leibovitz has helped define the look and spirit of this magazine. Wonderland, published by Phaidon, her latest monograph, is filled with an array of commissions for Vanity Fair. From the beginning, she writes, a legendary world where photographers were recognized as artists. Vogue and other publications, shot between 1972 and 2021. We see supermodel Natalia Vodianova as Alice in the proverbial book title. A pregnant Serena Williams, swathed in a billowing orange caftan. Nicole Kidman, circa Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut, and Rihanna, glamorous, beside a siren red car in the streets of Havana. Fashion has always been there, Leibovitz writes of her more than 50-year career. It is the driving force in a portrait. Whether it is Jerry Garcia in a black T-shirt, or Patti Smith in the much-imitated style that has endured for decades, or the Rolling Stones, fashion plays a part in the scheme of everything, but photography always comes first for me. Moving on to the fairground with photographs by Greg Williams, just for flicks, for the opening gala of the Academy Museum of Motion Pictures, stars galore celebrated at the new Renzo Piano-designed building, a Los Angeles destination 10 years in the making. In the photos, Tom Hanks shared the mic with Laura Dern, Bob Iger, Ava DuVernay, and Ted Sarandos. Selma Blair, Nicole Kidman, and Regina Hall. Annette Bening and husband Warren Beatty. Olivia Rodrigo, just after she exchanged digits with Katy Perry. Lady Gaga, who serenaded the crowd with jazz favorites, Visits with Cher. Regina King, one of 7 Oscar winners who appear on this page. Spike Lee, to whom Gaga dedicated her rendition of New York, New York. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Mel Brooks, the EGOT winner and author of All About Me, on limos, birthmarks, and the best vacation ever with Carl Reiner. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Being in a Broadway theater full of people laughing their heads off at one of my shows. What is your greatest fear? A Broadway theater filled with nothing but critics. What do you dislike most about your appearance? Looking older than I really am, I'm only in my 90s. What is your most marked characteristic? A strawberry on my tush and a unique sense of humor. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Benjamin Franklin. He was smart, witty, and had a lot of hair in the back. Which living person do you most admire? Probably me, but I don't think I'm supposed to say that. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Being too damned self-absorbed. Which living person do you most despise? My proctologist. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Never picking up the check. What is your greatest extravagance? I think it's taking limos to the airport and always flying first class. When and where were you happiest? Probably during my childhood, growing up in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Which talent would you most like to have? Bookkeeping. I know I'm being screwed, but I don't know how. What is your favorite journey? It happened every summer from about 1982 to around 1989. My best friend, Carl Reiner, bought a house in the south of France. My wife, Anne, and I, along with two other friends, would fly over to see Carl and his wife, Estelle. We'd eat, drink, play word games, and generally have a wonderful time. After 2 weeks, we would get up early in the morning and begin a drive to Venice. We would stop along the way to have breakfast in Genoa, then lunch in Bologna, and we'd arrive in Venice at sunset. Now that was a journey. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My family. What is your current state of mind? Mostly positive, with occasional bouts of anxiety. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? Height. I'd make them all taller, especially me. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? A giraffe. Have I mentioned I'd like to be taller? What do you most value in your friends? Taking daily showers and always being there when I need them. What do you consider your greatest achievement? The producers, both the original 1967 film and the 2001 Broadway musical. What are your favorite names? Bialystok and Bloom. Who are your heroes in real life? The nurses and doctors who selflessly show up to work every day and bravely battle COVID-19 in ICUs across the world. What is it that you most dislike? Nazis and oysters. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? My arabesque, I'd like to end it with a grand flourish. What is your motto? When you got it, flaunt it. What is your greatest regret? Agreeing to fill out this questionnaire. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Mel Brooks. The Jewel Case. What We May Have Lost When the Question of Vaping Got Political, by Vanessa Grigoriades. Opening photograph by Jamie Chung. Showing a young man, face obscured by a cloud of smoke, using a Juul pen. Juul reached Decacorn status, a $10 billion valuation quicker than any company in Silicon Valley history. It is easy to forget now, given the speed with which we grew accustomed to the sight of our fellow citizens noisily dragging on devices that wouldn't have been out of place on the set of Dune, but it was only in 2015 that Juul cracked the code on the unembarrassing electronic cigarette. Juul's sleek, USB-like design swiped away memories of earlier vapes, which were often clumsy metal representations of the real thing. The Juul was charged via computer port, giving it the feel of a well-polished Apple product appearing in your life to alleviate your anxiety. anxiety being the issue many smokers know is at the heart of their addiction. It was the gadget of smokers' dreams, and for creating it, co-founders James Monsees and Adam Bowen were handsomely rewarded. Juul reached Decacorn status, a $10 billion valuation, quicker than any company in Silicon Valley history. But Juul's rapid ubiquity and rise to such tech sector heights belied the small matter of its status with federal regulators. As it turns out, the devices have never been officially approved for use in the United States. For more than a decade, the FDA has punted the decision about whether e-cigarettes are a public health boon, leaving Americans to decide for themselves if vapes are a godsend with the potential to save the lives of millions of smokers, or the worst newfangled tech product to come along since the Zune, with the unfortunate side effect of potentially killing you. The FDA said it would weigh in when it had more information. Finally, in October, the agency granted word from on high that one favored e-cigarette was safe. It wasn't a Juul. Few who observed this fight were surprised by this outcome. For the past few years, Juul has been locked in a vicious battle with regulators, school districts, and states. To these antagonists, Juul is an immoral company that prized making billions over deep attention to the moral question at the heart of its controversial product. Is it worth saving the lives of some number of adult smokers by having Juul on the market if the price is nicotine addiction in young people, some number of whom will inevitably move on to combustible cigarettes and hasten their death? As the early leader in the space, Juul has traveled a bumpy path, drawing as much scrutiny as the Trump White House could muster and becoming yet another Silicon Valley cautionary tale along the way. In FX New York Times docuseries about the company's rise last fall was titled Move Fast and Vape Things. Juul once had 75% of the vaping market share in the U.S., and was down to 42% last year, but the FDA-approved e-cigarette R.J. Reynolds Vuse Solo Power Unit is far less popular. The agency, it would appear, would never give Juul the satisfaction of being the first vape in America to attain authorization to market. It would rather let Juul twist a bit longer in the wind. So, what exactly happened to the one-time darling? How did we go from "Dude, where's my Juul?" and scrambling for lost Juul pods under the seats of our cars to regarding the company as the evil empire? And will we ever go back to a time when Juuling was a verb, like Googling, or will it be forever thought of as an unfortunate cultural moment on par with a Tide Pod challenge? Vaping works by extracting nicotine from tobacco and turning it into a smokable liquid without setting it on fire. It's not nicotine that is toxic, but the tar and chemicals that come from combusting tobacco by lighting a cigarette. Half of the world's 1 billion smokers will die of smoking-related illnesses, making cigarettes arguably the most dangerous consumer product on the globe. But only Juul figured out how to make vapes so potent that they would satisfy smokers. Earlier rivals had exponentially less powerful blends of nicotine. The company had an elite pedigree. Monsees and Bowen created an early version of Juul as their product design master thesis at Stanford. They had a recombinant vision of marrying the tech and tobacco worlds, making both more humane and ethical, and spoke often about how Juul and its creme brulee-flavored vapor would save lives by satisfying nicotine cravings, yet not hastening one's demise. Identifying a big sweeping idea during our late age of tech, when VCs are more likely to be inundated with investment requests from companies delivering hamburgers than a humanity-saving piece of machinery, was a big deal. 3 years after they founded the company, Munsees and Bowen sold 35% of Juul to Altria, the company formerly known as Philip Morris Companies, for nearly $13 billion. But there was one large, potentially humanity-destroying problem. In order to make Juul as appealing to smokers as possible, and by that I mean delivering a nice buzz and head rush, Juul upped the percentage of nicotine in each vape over the potency of e-cigarettes authorized for sale in Europe, not a continent known for its lack of devotion to smoking. This head-buzzy Juul was pleasurable but also insanely addictive, and it proved to be a hit not only with smokers, the group of people Juul claimed it was trying to save, but also with a group of people known for chasing head buzzes, namely teenagers. Youth smoking has been on the decline since the 1990s. That was its peak in the U.S., with 36.4% of teens reporting they smoked the previous month in 1997. This victory is one of the few bright spots in America's otherwise sad public health regimen. Obesity and alcoholism come to mind. Most of the country's 34 million smokers are Gen X or older. Today, the habit doesn't only stain teeth, wrinkle lips, and age the face. Now, you look older just because you do it. But Juul destabilized this progress, turning an estimated 6 million American youths into nicotine fiends, according to Robert Jakler, a Stanford professor and key anti-vaping advocate. Left on the bedside table of a teenager, a parent wouldn't recognize it as a smoking device, and they became a thing for kids, like Beanie Babies, hula hoops, or fidget spinners, says Jakler. Juul could never have designed such a big fad, because no company could engineer that. But once it happened, they knew about it, and here's the rub. They went after it, and it succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.